Somebody in the foyer told me this morning before the second service that last Sunday's message took them from being pro-abortion to pro-life, which I was blessed to know that was my goal, is my goal. We asked the question, is human life more valuable than animal life? We answered that with yes, absolutely. You say, why would we ask such a silly question? Have you seen the billboard on your way to Bakersfield that says, animals are children too? We're living in a society where we're drifting. We're drifting, and this is how the drift is occurring. We're dumbing down the value of human life and thereby elevating the value of animal life. And pretty soon we're going to be hearing arguments, and we already have from ethicist Peter Singer, that there should be no distinction between the value of human life and animal life. And to make that distinction is to be guilty of speciesism, which is a form of racism applied to the species. Well, if God hasn't spoken, if God doesn't have an opinion on the matter, then all we're left with is human opinion. And human opinion varies, is whimsical, fickle, arbitrary. And prior to Roe versus Wade, personhood was attached to biology. In order to be a person, you just had to have live human embryo, and personhood was attached to that. Once conception took place, the unborn was safe in the womb because the unborn was considered a person. And what gave it personhood? The fact that it had human DNA, was alive, and thereby was a human being, and that was enough to identify it as a person. So the definition of personhood went from biological to, after Roe versus Wade, a sociological definition. And the idea became that a person is not, a living being is not a person until it has sociological capacities to relate and have relationships with other people, to contemplate about the past, to think about the present, and to plan for the future. And that definition is so varied and broad and arbitrary that it's known as a stipulated definition of personhood. Now, anytime people stipulate a definition, you can stipulate a new definition at will. So we started with biological. You can pull that slide if you don't mind just for a moment. We started off with a biological definition of personhood, and we drifted into a sociological definition of personhood because as long as the unborn was identified as a person, people were uncomfortable with taking the life of the unborn. But as soon as the definition of personhood changed, that discomfort went away, at least in part. So we need to reject the idea that you can stipulate the definition of personhood and derive it from a sociological definition, but rather we need to maintain that personhood is determined by the biological entity that is there in the womb at conception. Now, why is that important? Our founding fathers said in the Declaration of Independence that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and here's the key word, are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, those words were very important, and they were crafted on purpose and intentionally to communicate certain values. And the one value they wanted us to take away from that was this: God endows your rights. Government does not. Ethicists don't. Physicians don't. Sociologists, psychologists, psychiatrists, not even clergymen give you your rights. God endows you with your rights. And guess what else God endows you with? Your personhood. And He does so by virtue of the fact that He has made you in the image of God, and your value starts at the moment of conception. So you have a choice. You can allow God to define personhood, or you can allow man to define personhood. What's the difference between one and the other? When God defines personhood, your personhood is objective. It's there. It can't be taken away. It's unalienable, just like your rights to the life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. When man defines your personhood, he can also remove that definition, change the definition, just sort of like the difference between laws against murder and laws against double dribbling. There are laws against double dribbling in the NBA. They made those rules up. They thought it was a good rule, but they can change it. And I remember when I was in junior high, there were laws against carrying in the basketball game. You remember that? You couldn't carry the ball when you dribbled? I don't think they have that in the NBA anymore. But there is a technical rule in the NBA that you can't carry the ball when you dribble it. What happens to NBA rules? What happens to NFL rules? The NFL rules changed during the playoffs. Did you notice that? During overtime, the rules changed. It used to be the first one to score in overtime wins the game. How could they arbitrarily change it for the playoffs? Because man-made rules can be arbitrarily changed at any moment. God's rules can't. Now, do you want your personhood defined by man? Or do you want it defined by God? Do you want your personhood to be something that is consistent and stays with you throughout your existence? Or do you want it to be arbitrarily stipulated that now that you wear glasses, you're no longer a person? You say, that's absurd. It's not absurd. Do you know what happened in the 1857 Dred Scott case? The Supreme Court ruled in 1857 that black people were not persons. Now get this. They somehow figured, I haven't found the calculator to be able to do this math, that they were three-fifths a person. Three-fifths a person. In Nazi Germany, Hitler declared that Jews were non-persons. Now, what were Jews before Hitler decided to declare them non-persons? What were blacks before Dred Scott decided to declare them non-persons? Let me tell you what they were. They were what they were from the moment of conception, and they were the same thing after conception, and they were the same thing before Dred Scott, and they were the same thing after Dred Scott, and they were the same thing when they died. Arbitrary definitions do not change the status of what we are. God declares what we are, and we remain what we are from conception till death. Created in the image of God, sacred to God and sacred to one another, or we should be. So we ask the question, when is the unborn a person? We answered it with medical, philosophical, and biological data. And we answered it with the answer that the unborn is a person from the moment of conception. Now, let's consider the possibility, and this is rhetorical, that we don't really know what the unborn is. We don't know whether the unborn is a person. Now, that's an absurd argument to make, because as soon as a family wants the unborn, how is the unborn treated? It's given a name, a room assigned in the home, decorations, if they know the gender. They sing to the baby. They talk to the baby. They buy curriculum for the baby. All of a sudden, the baby takes on personhood when the desire of the parent changes. Why is that? Because everyone knows the baby's a person. The only time that's called into question is when somebody wants to get rid of the baby, whether that be a mother or father or both. But let's suppose, for sake of discussion, that we don't really know whether it's a person or not. When you go out hunting and you don't know whether the noise in the bush is a deer or a fellow hunter, what is the wisest course of action to take? Ready, shoot, aim? Ready, fire, aim? Is that the right way to do it? No, we err on the side of caution, and we treat that noise in the bush as though it might be a fellow hunter, because to do otherwise is to risk a tragedy. If it is the case that we don't know what the unborn is, we ought to err on the side of caution and treat it as though it is a person rather than treating it as though it is not, because the stakes are very high. The stakes are very high. And every bit of evidence that we have been able to study and research shows that this embryo, this fetus, is in fact not a potential person, but a person. All the factors that go into the DNA that establish the personhood of the unborn only change in degree over the course of that child's life. And those differences are not morally relevant differences. Now we have to ask and answer another question that we introduced last week, and that is abortion murder? Is abortion murder? And again, I want to clarify what I don't mean by that. I do not mean that a young lady or woman or husband or boyfriend has in mind when they choose abortion the idea of murdering their child. I think our culture has drifted so far in the last 40 years that a person can do this without having much of a conscience issue because of what our culture has constantly told them about the identity of the unborn. Oh, it's just a clump of tissue. Oh, it's just like going to the dentist and having a tooth extracted. Oh, it's not alive. Oh, if it is alive, it's not a person. We're not sure that it's human, etc., etc. All the rhetoric that we hear about abortion has desensitized people so that they can walk into an abortion clinic today and get an abortion and have their conscience pricked only just a little, whereas the same woman, having done so in 1972, would have been devastated by that act, because what was the difference between 1972 and 2012? What we identify the unborn as being. Now, what the unborn is hasn't changed in those 40 years, but what we call it has changed. So when I ask the question, is abortion murder, I don't mean to imply intent on the part of the person getting an abortion. I mean, actually, what is going on when an abortion takes place? But before you can define whether it's murder or not, you have to define what murder is. Murder is the intentional killing of an innocent human being. Now, why doesn't capital punishment then rise to the level of murder? Some people call it murder, but it's not. You know why? Because it's the intentional killing of a guilty human being. Why doesn't war constitute murder, a just war? Because it's the intentional killing of an enemy in a just war that's been duly declared by those who have been given the authority to declare such. Why isn't self-defense considered murder? For the same reasons. Abortion, however, does not constitute just killing. It has to constitute murder because, number one, the unborn is intentionally killed, and the unborn is innocent, and the unborn is a human being. So all the definitions, all the variables that go into defining murder also go into defining abortion. Now, you can put that slide up. Whether we call abortion murder depends on whether we call the unborn a person. So in Nazi Germany, if you didn't call a Jew a person, you could kill him. Now, did that change what the Jew was? No. So what we call a person should not be confused with what a person actually is. You understand the difference. But whether abortion is murder depends upon whether the unborn is a person. Being a person and simply being called a person are not to be confused. I could call you a frog. Does that change what you really are? Not at all. Well, you can't legislate morality. That's the next question that we need to answer. Can you legislate morality? Let's just have a talk right there this morning. Let's have a talk. Can you legislate morality? That's right. What would you legislate if not morality? What would you legislate? Now, it depends on what you mean by the question. If you mean, can we pass laws that change people's hearts? The answer is no. So if the question, can we legislate morality, is asking, can we change people's hearts by passing laws? The answer is no. The Bible's clear about that. The Bible says the law only gives us knowledge of what we've done wrong. It doesn't have the power to correct what we've done wrong. It makes us aware of our violation, but it doesn't change whether we're going to commit that violation. But if you mean, can you legislate morality? If you mean by that question, can we pass laws that have morality as their foundation? The answer is yes. We do all the time. In the Vietnam War, those who did not favor the Vietnam War were against it primarily because they thought it was unjust. Not because it wasn't being managed properly. That was another argument for getting out of Vietnam, that it wasn't managed properly. It was being managed by politicians instead of soldiers. But those on this side of the ocean who demonstrated in colleges and universities and protested against the Vietnam War did so primarily on a moral foundation. And they wanted laws to be passed that had a moral foundation. You see, the question is not, can you legislate morality? The question is, whose morality? Because laws are going to have a moral foundation, the question is, whose foundation will be legislated, not whether or not morality will be legislated. We have laws against murder. That's a moral issue. We have laws against stealing. That's a moral issue. We have laws against extortion. That's a moral issue. We have laws against rape. That's a moral issue. We have laws against child abuse. That's a moral issue. We have stop signs. Why do we have stop signs? Because we want to protect human life. So we require people to stop at intersections to avoid accidents, which would harm other human beings. I realize there's also the money side of that law, insurance claims and so on and so forth. But at the heart of stop sign laws are morality and moral issues. Even if you could not legislate morality in terms of changing people's hearts, there must be laws regulating deeds. You can't do away with murder laws. You can't do away with theft laws. You cannot do away with raping. You cannot do away with laws against arson. You cannot do away with laws against extortion. You cannot do away with every law that has a moral foundation. For in order to do so, you do away with most of the laws that we've passed in this land. Now, Martin Luther King, whose birthday we celebrated recently, said, "We hear the familiar cry that morals can't be legislated. This may be true, but behavior can be regulated. The law may not make me able to love, make a man love me, but it can keep him from lynching me." And the fact of the matter is, we don't want to make people good. We want to stop their actions that are wrong. And if we can't stop their actions, we want to provide penalties for those actions. That's what law is all about. It is the church's job to change people from the inside with the gospel. And let me just be quick to say that my once-a-year sermon on pro-life human the sacredness of human life is not because our church is a political church. The flag on the top of our flagpole is not abortion. It's the gospel of Jesus Christ. And I think it's a mistake for a church to trade the gospel for political activism. But I also think that it is not inconsistent with the gospel to protect innocent human life and to stand up against the destruction of innocent human life. In Nazi Germany in the late 30s, early 40s, the church, as it gathered on Sunday mornings to sing hymns and hear the Word of God preached, could hear the railroad cars go by as Hitler carried Jews off to the extermination camps. And I've read reports of people who lived back in that time saying that all we did to ignore what was obviously going on was sing just a little louder to drown out the noise of the railroad cars. God forbid that we would just sing a little louder on Sunday mornings and ignore the Holocaust that is abortion. We have aborted over 40 million babies since 1973, twice as many as Stalin killed, and several times as many as Hitler killed during the Holocaust. So you can legislate morality, we do. But we're told that unenforceable laws should not exist. Since Roe versus Wade, the United States averages 1.5 million abortions per year, over 50 million in the last 39 years. In March of 1857, the Supreme Court once decreed that a black man was not a person in the Dred Scott case. Nazi laws decreed that Jews were, in effect, non-persons. Thus, Hitler convinced thousands of people that exterminating 6 million Jews was acceptable. So you can legislate morality, and we ought to legislate morality. If you don't legislate morality, then by default, somebody else's morality will be legislated. It's unavoidable. The last question that we asked, and now we need to answer. But what about tolerance and compassion for the mother who's in a crisis pregnancy, or the boyfriend or the husband who's encouraging her to have an abortion? We're told we should be tolerant. We shouldn't force a woman to have a child, a prisoner to the electric chair, or a soldier to the battlefield. But liberal abortion laws allow some people to force death on the unborn. Pro-abortionists don't believe in restricting a woman's choice, but they don't have a problem restricting the life of the unborn. Well, we're told we don't want to force pro-lifers to have abortions, but they want to force us not to have abortions. This demonstrates that pro-abortion people are less restrictive. Is it not the most severe restriction to be killed? If you really are against force, why do you want to force death on unwilling millions? Well, I'm against abortion, we're told, but I don't want to impose my personal views on those who disagree with me. Why wouldn't you want to impose your personal views on those who disagree with me? Would disagree with you. You don't have a problem doing that when it comes to murder. You disagree with murder, and you think it's fine to impose your values on others when it comes to passing laws against murder. Same thing with arson and theft and rape. You personally oppose those things, and you don't have any problem imposing that value upon those who would like to do those things. You endorse passing laws and keeping laws that prevent people from doing those things. You're imposing your values on others. It's unavoidable. The question is not, do we impose our values? The question is, whose values should be imposed? You cannot get away with the fact that, you cannot avoid the fact that values will be imposed. The only other option is a valueless society. And a valueless society is a value all its own. It's sort of like the guy who says, I'm not going to decide. Well, that in itself is a decision. There is no neutral ground. There is no neutrality. There is no demilitarized zone. To not decide is to decide, and there in the vacuum, leave someone else's values in place. Well, suppose the KKK wanted to begin lynching again. Would you be imposing your values on them by making and enforcing laws against lynching? Suppose a neo-Nazi party arose and wanted to begin exterminating Jews again. Would you be imposing your values on them by restricting their activities? You certainly would. Well, we want laws that are compassionate, laws that help people, do not repress them and restrict them. Why? By protecting against bombs, inflation, rape, and lynching, and genocide, but not against abortion? We've already established that the unborn are people too. What about them? Well, we're against the use of force. We appreciate everyone the way they are. We shouldn't force women to do something they don't want to do. Isn't abortion the use of force to change the unborn from the living to the dead? There are people who don't want the responsibility of their children, their aged parents. Does that mean we should give them the right to murder them because they have become an inconvenience? Pro-lifers use such harsh language in their arguments. Abortion is a harsh reality. 1.5 million unborn babies are killed by abortion each year in the United States. But a woman should have reproductive freedom. A woman has reproductive freedom. She has five choices. She can choose chastity. By the way, that is a choice. It may be a difficult choice. It may be even a choice that brings on a certain amount of emotional and physical suffering. But it is a choice. She has the choice of contraception. That's reproductive freedom. Whether or not you agree with contraception is not my point. Currently, in the United States, women have this choice. That's freedom. She has the choice of abortion since 1973. She has the choice of adopting her children out to a family who cannot have children. We have firsthand knowledge of this. And we're thankful for adoption. Thankful for that option. She can choose, everybody gasp, motherhood. That's reproductive freedom. There's only one choice in that list that we should oppose, and that is abortion. Now, someone might say, but that may cause suffering in the life of the mother or the boyfriend or the father or the husband who's encouraging abortion. It's going to be a financial burden to raise the child. It's going to be an emotional trauma to raise the child. It's going to do whatever the pro-abortion lobby suggests produces suffering. So someone might ask, why is chastity, contraception, and adoption and motherhood preferable to abortion? Well, let me spell it out. If you inflict suffering upon me, suffering cannot hurt me unless I let it. If you suffer from chastity, contraception, adoption, the emotional pain of letting someone else raise your child, or motherhood, the difficulties and hardships that come with raising any child, those things can refine you and make you a better person. They cannot hurt your soul. Suffering never hurts the soul. In fact, the Bible teaches very clearly, and we just went through an epistle of 1 Peter, that God can use suffering to make us better. Count it all joy, my brothers, when you enter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance. And endurance, when it's allowed to have its complete work in you, will find you perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. In other words, God has a way of taking the sufferings that come into our life and making us better if we give those sufferings to God. What does God want to do with the family who's been told, you're going to have a baby, but there's a 90% chance that this child will have Down syndrome? If you want to know, talk to Randy and Lori Kitt, who had Ben several years ago, over 20 years ago, and Randy Kitt will tell you that Ben, the Down syndrome son, has taught them more about love than anybody in their family, extended or otherwise. In other words, these things that happen to us that bring suffering of whatever kind can make us better people, and they cannot harm our soul. Do you understand that? But when I do evil, you remember Joseph? His brothers were afraid at the end of Genesis chapter 50. Maybe now that Jacob has died, Joseph is going to take out his vengeance upon us. And so they pleaded with him to be merciful. And you know what he said to them? What you intended for evil against me, God used for the good of me and the saving of millions. What damages the human soul is not having evil perpetrated upon you, but being the one who perpetrates evil upon someone else. You see, you can inflict suffering upon me and never touch my soul. In fact, my soul can be refined and purified through it. But if I do evil to you, then I damage my own soul. It is compassionate to try to provide reasons for people to avoid doing evil. It is compassionate. I'm going to get emails. You're intolerant. You're unconcerned for the birth mother. You're unthinking and intolerant and lacking compassion for women in crisis pregnancies. I don't consider it compassion when we give people permission to do what's wrong. It is compassion when you warn them to not do it. That's reproductive freedom, my friends. But the next slide shows it is always morally preferable to suffer evil than to commit evil. It is always morally preferable. Suffering only harms the body. Committing evil harms the soul. Now, is the unborn a person? Yes, we know it is. Many of you had questions at the end of last Sunday's sermon about end-of-life decisions. I want to recommend a book called The Basic Questions on the End of Life by Stewart et al. You can find this at Amazon.com. I'll be posting my slides on the website so you can examine them more closely. But this book answers several questions. Is death a natural part of life, and what should be my attitude toward it? When am I dying or in the process of dying? How aggressively should we treat people with potentially fatal illnesses or injuries? How do I prepare adequately for the dying process? Is it selfish to want to be in control during the dying process? Should I consider organ donation? If so, when? If I'm old or disabled or my quality of life is low, is my life of less value? Depends on how you define personhood. If you define it in a utilitarian fashion, guess what? The less utility you have, the less value you have. If you define it in a biological sense, in the sense of what are you, not what can you do, your value is the same from conception till death. It answers questions like, what are the roles of the patient, the physician, and the family members in treatment decision making? Who needs to know that I am dying or may be dying? What are informed consent and mental competence? Do I have a legal right to determine my medical treatment? What treatment and financial plans should I make while I am still healthy? What are advanced directives? What are advanced directives, and are they a good idea? Who makes treatment decisions for an incompetent patient with no advanced directive? When is hospitalization appropriate? What is a long-term care? What about end-of-life decisions, terminating life support? What is a do not resuscitate order, and when is it appropriate? Should I be cautious about initiating life support for fear that removal may be difficult? What factors should a patient, a family, or other decision makers consider before deciding to terminate life support? If I remove life support, am I responsible for the death? Is it ever ethical to withhold fluids and nutrition? Should my desire to be with Christ in eternity play a part in the end-of-life decisions? And then suffering. Should suffering be avoided at all costs? Boy, that's a question I could preach on for an hour. You know what my answer to that is? No. For the very reasons I gave earlier. Everybody I've ever known who suffered, who gave their suffering to God, was better for having suffered than those who didn't. Now, I'm not advocating masochism or sadomasochism, where you invite suffering, you look for it, you hunt for it, you inflict it upon yourself, self-flagellation or anything like that. Suffering will happen to you in the normal course of life if you just live. But let me just diatribe for just a moment. We are so quick to make sure our kids don't ever suffer, because suffering is horrible for them. Well, it can be, but what determines whether suffering is horrible or not is how we respond to it. Did you hear what I just said? Listen to me. Our culture doesn't know this. Suffering doesn't hurt your children unless your children let it hurt them. And how would you let suffering hurt you? By reacting and sinning in the midst of your suffering. By not grabbing hold of God for your identity and your self-worth. By sinning in response to your suffering. See, what hurts your soul is evil. Joseph was a better man for all the suffering he went through. Job was a better man for all the suffering he went through. Jesus endured the cross and suffered for us. And Paul says in Philippians chapter 3 that he wanted to know Jesus so well that he wanted to know him in the power of his resurrection and in the fellowship of his sufferings. Paul thought of suffering as an opportunity. Isn't that foreign to our culture? How does my knowledge of Jesus' last days affect the way I live my own last days? Should I ask God to relieve my suffering? Yes. How can I cope with suffering God doesn't relieve? God. Do physicians have the means available to control physical pain adequately? What is hospice and what can it do for me or my loved ones? Amy and I had to answer these questions when Amy's mother was given about 2 months to live with terminal cancer. We spent the last days with her, the last 30 days with her, by her bedside. And then we had to face the same question again when my dad had a massive stroke in 2006 and lived for 5 days. We had to discuss with the physicians what we wanted to do and not to do. These are very critical and important questions. Some of you are nurses and you've asked me the question because you deal with it all the time. This book helps answer those questions from a biblical worldview. And it distinguishes between letting nature take its course, which is not murder, and intervening and taking active measures to end a life before it would naturally end, which is a different matter altogether. But the details of that are spelled out in this book, and I commend it to you so that you have a better grasp on these ethical issues. We will be teaching a class on ethics when I'm finished with my apologetics class on Sunday evening, and the class will deal with a number of issues, one of which is end-of-life decisions, because this is not going to go away, especially with the changing definition of person. Get this, this doesn't just apply to abortion. It applies across the spectrum. What are you? Well, it just so happens that most of you, by the current definition of personhood, are persons. Aren't you glad? But if that definition changes, somebody does the moral calculus and figures out you're only 3/5 a person, arbitrarily, you're in trouble. Let's pray. Lord, help us to recover a biblical frame of reference to these matters. We have drifted so far as a culture that even Christians don't recognize what ought to be clear for each one of us. And Lord, I know that I, even one who deals with Scripture daily, am a part of this culture that has drifted, and I know that my eyes don't see clearly as they ought because of the darkness that has been creeping into our country and our culture and into our thinking. I pray you would clear away the fog and help us to see clearly. As unpopular as that makes us, as uncouth as we may be to some, we would rather please you than others. Help us to know how to do that. And Lord, even while we oppose abortion, we love those who are caught up in it. We don't just love the unborn, we love the mother and the father and the husband and the boyfriend. And we know that forgiveness is available to anyone who wants to turn away from their sin and turn to you in repentance. And I pray, Lord, that whoever's suffering from shame or guilt, whether that be from abortion or any other sin, would embrace you and ask you for forgiveness. You abundantly pardon. Your mercies are new every morning to those who are broken and contrite.